Good evening and welcome to the January 2026 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. Well, fighting to keep our community recognized and visible today isn't the first time in our history when government forces have tried to erase us. Tonight, our three guests share what they're doing to fight back, starting with Roberto Ordonana and Gerard Kosovich from the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. Then Finn Dearhart talks with David Robinson, who learned about activism after joining ACT UP back in 1986, and he'll share with us what he thinks we should be doing today. Rafe Durazi also joins us with this month's Outbeat News Roundup. So stay with us, it's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, January 25th, 2026. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of January 25th, 2026. In Russia, fans of the popular show Heated Rivalry are being charged with violating the anti-LGBTQ+ speech law as the show's popularity spreads across the country. The crackdown coincides with Russians who had reportedly finding ways to view the hit gay series. Russian authorities have charged executives at some of the country's top streaming services with violating Russia's anti-LGBTQ+ propaganda law. According to the Moscow Times, independent Russian-language news outlet Mediazona first reported on the charges against 8 different streaming companies. At least one executive, digital television program director Alexei Bernat, has been charged with, quote, subjecting minors to LGBTQ+ propaganda, end quote. Heated Rivalry is a TV series about the romance between two deeply closeted hockey players, one of whom who is Russian. Russian-born journalist Mikhail Zygarde describes the series as being extraordinarily successful. In a recent piece for Vanity Fair, Zygarde reported that the series has an 8.6 rating on Russia's equivalent of Rotten Tomatoes, a higher rating than both Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad, the platform's two most watched shows. But under Russian law, so-called LGBTQ+ propaganda has been banned in the presence of minors since 2013. In late 2022, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed legislation expanding the 2013 law to effectively outlaw any public expression of LGBTQ+ life in the country. And in 2023, Russia's Supreme Court declared, quote, the international LGBT social movement as an extremist organization, end quote. Here in the U.S., National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman was asked about the hit show, and he says, quote, I'm a big fan. I've watched all 6 episodes. I binged it all in one night. Bettman added, quote, I thought the storyline was very compelling and a lot of fun, because I could see where they were picking at things that we had in the past, whether it was Olympics in Sochi or the All-Star Game in Tampa. It was very well done, end quote. Heated Rivalry is a TV adaptation of Rachel Reid's hockey romance novel, and it's become a cultural phenomenon. It reached the number one spot for the most popular TV shows online and broke into HBO Max's global top 10, topping charts in countries like the Philippines, Singapore, and Australia. It's already been renewed for a second season. And here in California, the victim of a severe beating in Sacramento's queer Lavender Heights neighborhood was laid to rest on January 10th, as the community grapples with what to do next. Prosecutors are evaluating whether to upgrade charges against the suspect to include homicide. The victim was a 58-year-old man, Alvin Prasad, who was attacked on November 1st outside Badlands in Sacramento. Prasad was in a coma and on life support and never regained consciousness. The suspect in the case is Sean Wesley Payton, 24 years old, who was initially charged by the Sacramento DA's office with felony assault and misdemeanor charges of resisting arrest, to which he pleaded not guilty. He was subsequently charged with an added hate crime enhancement. He's next scheduled to appear in court on January 30th. The attack is only one of a string of violent and troubling incidents, which led to the Sacramento LGBT Community Center's town hall meeting back on December 16th. About 50 people attended the meeting and expressed their frustration with both Sacramento Police and the LGBT Center about having done nothing to make the community feel safer following the attack. And here in Santa Rosa, the Santa Rosa Junior College has landed on a list of college systems across the country being targeted for investigation by the Trump administration for allegedly discriminating against women athletes for letting transgender individuals participate in intercollegiate sports. The list published by the U.S. Department of Education includes 18 institutions ranging from K-12 school districts to state departments of education. In addition to Santa Rosa JC, three other institutions in California, including Santa Monica Junior College and two Southern California school districts, made the list. All were reported to the department's Office of Civil Rights for maintaining, quote, policies or practices that discriminate on the basis of sex by permitting students to participate in sports based on their gender identity, not biological sex, end quote. Santa Rosa JC officials issued a statement that says the college will participate in the investigation. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. As forces in the federal government are trying to erase or rewrite our history, the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco is working hard to preserve and keep visible our truth. Gerard Kosovich was one of the founding members of the Historical Society, and Roberto Ordignano is the current CEO. Gerard and Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah, and I'm excited to talk about the Historical Society, the museum, and this news about a new building coming up. But, you know, I think for our listeners, we've covered certainly stories over the years about the work of the Historical Society and certainly the museum. But for those who aren't familiar with how this Historical Society all came about, Gerard, maybe you can share what was your experience back in 1985 and what drew you to the work?
Certainly, as a founding member, I can talk a bit about the origins of the Historical Society. In San Francisco, there have been people doing what we would call LGBTQ plus public history work, so not based in universities, but out in the wider world, at least since the 1950s, possibly the 1940s. There's a long, unbroken tradition of people in San Francisco saying, are there people like us who've had a past? What was it like before we got here? Initially, there was, in 1978, an organization called the San Francisco Lesbian and Gay History Project, which was a private study group with some of the people who went on to become great, great names in the field. And out of that project came a proposal to create an archives, a study center, a more formal institution. Willie Walker, one of our founders, proposed this idea, and that group discussed it for a while. Ultimately, five people got together and said, to make this happen, we need to have a public meeting, invite anybody who might be interested in supporting this project to join us and get going. And so on March 16th, 1985, at the old public library, a public meeting attended by about 60 people from throughout Northern California was held and voted to found what was originally called the Gay and Lesbian Historical Society of Northern California. Actually, I take that back. It was the Bay Area Gay and Lesbian Historical Society and then changed its name subsequently. And that was the start. It started with those 60 people with maybe $400 out of our own pockets put together and with about 15 banker's boxes of archival material that were stored in Willie Walker's living room. And what we had was a shared notion that one way to belong in place, in time, in our society, is to own our past, to know what it was, to feel it belonged to us, to have it serve as a foundation for changing the present, for dreaming about a different future, that we had an inheritance that we had lost and needed to find. We had no idea if there would be people interested in using an archives of that sort. Could we get together a large collection? Would there be researchers? That was all just a hope and a dream. And of course, it turned out very quickly that there was a real shared passion for this notion that we needed to find our own past, document it, interpret it, and make sure that other people knew about it. So that's the beginning. The impetus at that moment in 1985 was twofold. First, we were at the point where the founders of the homophile movement, the first organized movement for lesbian and gay emancipation in the United States, the Mattachine Society founded in 1950, the Daughters of Bilitis founded in 1955, both long time had their headquarters in San Francisco. The founders were reaching their late 60s, early 70s. We had been through an enormous amount of change by 1985 with the gay liberation movement, with a whole coming out in public. And people were aware that that history was going to be lost, the memory of that time, the records of that time, risked disappearing in the next 10 years. At the same time, we were already in the darkest years of the AIDS pandemic.
Right, right.
And we had all witnessed, literally, I saw this and numerous people saw it, we had witnessed gay men dying of AIDS, their families showing up and throwing in the trash everything that documented their life as a gay person. Mm-hmm. These families wanted to have a straight dead person in their family, not a gay one. And we literally had collectors like me retrieving memorabilia, letters, scrapbooks from recycling bins.
Jeez.
And so there was a fear that just as our society erased our past, our memory of our movements from the 1950s, all those earlier lives, it was now in the process of letting us die and doing its best to make sure nobody would remember that that had happened. So we also really went about documenting the current moment that was so dramatic to make sure no one could ever say the AIDS crisis didn't happen and we didn't know whose fault it was. So there really were two strong reasons to do this. And our first published newsletter talks about both of those things as being motivations for creating the organization.
Fantastic. You know, and I don't even think I have to ask the question about how you got interested in this, because I can feel your passion for history and for these stories just in your words. Was there something in particular? Have you always been interested in history?
From the time I was a little kid, I loved old books and old paper and old buildings. In part, I think, as a working class baby queer in the Los Angeles area, the past was a place where I could be safe.
Yeah.
The present was too dangerous. And so from very early on, I had that passion. And by the time I was in my undergraduate years, I went to UC Santa Barbara and then on to graduate work at Stanford. I was already avidly looking to read anything I could find about the queer past, to collect anything I could find about it, to meet the oldest queer person in the room if I went to an event and asked them for about their stories. So by the time the Historical Society came along, I had already founded at Stanford University, where I was a grad student, an initiative there to try to document the LGBTQ plus history of the university. We started that in 1981, so 4 years before the Historical Society. And that's one reason I was invited to that founding meeting. I knew a couple of the people who organized that meeting. Mm-hmm. So it's been a lifelong passion for me.
Love it. Love it. Now, Roberto, we've had CEOs from the Historical Society on our show over the years, different generations. Tell me about yourself and what drew you to this work.
Yeah. I was born and raised in San Francisco. My family immigrated from Nicaragua and Central America in the 60s. And, you know, I think we think of San Francisco being an incredibly supportive place for LGBTQ community members. And indeed, there is a magic that happens around that support here. But nonetheless, people still struggle. And it was, you know, in the 90s where I was growing up, going to Catholic school, mm-hmm. and then later San Francisco State University, where I really was able to better understand the impacts, right, that LGBTQ people were facing here at home, and really try to wrap my head around what difference I could make. You know, I was bullied as a kid here in this town. You know, San Francisco wasn't ideally the safest place, but it marketed itself as such. And so, you know, I started doing HIV AIDS work in the late 90s with a group called the Stop AIDS Project. I studied human sexuality studies at San Francisco State University and got, you know, just engaged with a lot of individuals doing amazing work like Gerard. And over the years, I've just dedicated my life to working at the intersections of supporting the most marginalized in our LGBTQ communities. For the majority of that time, I was working at the San Francisco LGBTQ Community Center, building programs and fundraising and getting the organization to be the sustainable, incredible institution that it is today. And this opportunity opened up about a decade after I had served on the San Francisco Arts Commission as president in particular. And I had to say, it has been such a rewarding experience to work with incredible founders and founding members like Gerard, an incredibly dedicated staff and group of volunteers who pour their hearts into this amazing work that is needed more today than ever before. You know, I think hearing a little bit about Gerard's experience, I think what you're talking about, Gerard, is combating that erasure, right, that our community was facing back then. And there's a direct through line to this moment that we're living in today, right? We are seeing increased attacks against the most vulnerable within our LGBTQ community, including trans and gender non-binary children and young people, immigrants and undocumented LGBTQ community members in particular, women, people of color, people from the Latinx community and the Black community in particular. And our work to create greater access to LGBTQ history has never been more vital now than I think any moment in our history. And so it is an incredible privilege and blessing to help this organization continue to grow and to continue to reach a global audience that wants to learn a little bit more about where we came from and whose shoulders we stand on, and models for how we can really look at building a more supportive and thriving future for our community.
It's so interesting. We are very much at a time, I would say, that parallels 1985 under different circumstances. But some of the themes are the same. We were in a fight then and we are in a fight now. And in, like in both times, the richness and depth of our history is really important to keeping us all visible. And so
what's frightening?
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. What's frightening for me is we are also in a time that very much parallels 90 plus years ago. In 1933, the world's first great archives and library that focused on LGBTQ plus people, the Institute for Sexual Science of Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld in Berlin, was sacked and burned by the Nazi regime, a physical book burning. And within the first 3 weeks of the MAGA regime coming to the White House, the federal government went on a campaign of what I've dubbed digital book burning to erase LGBTQ history and LGBTQ knowledge from all federal websites and digital repositories. So there are frightening parallels between the last round of fascism attempting to erase LGBTQ people and our culture and the current round.
Boy, you're not kidding. You are not kidding. And to hear you go back to the 1930s, that's frightening. It really is frightening. I want to talk about, there's really two sort of major pieces of the historical society that are at least visible to me. There's the physical museum, which we'll come to, and then there's the archive, which is perhaps less visible in terms of the Castro and the public space. But you talked about some of the things that were collected early on for that archive, but what is available to researchers there sort of in the big picture? What kinds of things would researchers find there?
Well, we have over 1,000 collections, really spanning over a century's worth of LGBTQ history in San Francisco and Northern California. I believe it's one of the largest archives and repositories across the world. And so each year, hundreds and hundreds, close to 500 researchers and students and educators, artists, journalists, community members get to access these incredible materials for free and really dig in and get their hands engaged in these incredible materials that have been preserved in our archives for many years and will continue to be preserved moving forward. We've got incredible periodical collections, photography, art and artifacts, costumes, papers that really document where we've been and some of the challenges and the opportunities that our community has been able to glean from.
I'll add that the collection is particularly rich in a kind of material that seems obvious until you look for it. the papers that document the lives of ordinary LGBTQ people. How did they survive, work, find love, put up with persecution, somehow build a life against the odds, create social networks, begin to create movements, create a culture? Everybody has a grandma's attic with their family's papers in it documenting the lives of ordinary straight and cisgender people. But our family attic doesn't exist until we build it. And I sometimes refer to the Historical Society's archives as the queer and trans family attic, where we can find the lives of ordinary people like us in the past who we don't find in our biological families' photo albums. And documenting those lives has been one of the hardest things to do for historians. If you're a famous writer or an important filmmaker and you happen to be queer or trans, that's nice and we love those papers, but it's really the never heard of this person until I saw their photo album. Those are the ones I love. For example, we have a great pair of photo albums of a lesbian couple, a Jewish white woman and an African-American Christian woman who performed an unofficial marriage for themselves in 1973 in San Francisco. And we have their wedding album. And then 25 years later, living in the Jewish home for the aged in retirement, they had a recommitment ceremony, and we have the album of that ceremony documenting what happened in their old age as they lived their lives out. That's the unbelievable treasures from my point of view. Everybody's seen their grandparents' wedding albums, but we haven't seen our lesbian grandparents' wedding albums. It's deeply moving for me to be able to touch those ordinary lives that seem to have been erased and lost. Our work is to make sure they're not erased and lost. They're honored, they're remembered, they're shared, and become part of our common heritage.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, bringing students to the Castro and then to the museum, most of whom who have never been, some ever been to San Francisco, let alone to the neighborhood and to the museum. And a lot of these students are LGBT identified or sort of figuring that out. And they are moved. I'm curious for each of you, what are the exhibits in the museum that move you the most? Roberto, let's start with you.
I think for me, you know, is Gilbert is the pride flag, right? We preserve and make accessible to the community the last remaining piece of the original pride flag that flew in 1978 for the 1978 LGBT Pride celebration. And I have seen people come through to the museum and just sit in incredible awe and deep emotion. You know, that was one of the first symbols, right, that helped to articulate the vibrancy of our community, the strength of our community. And obviously so many symbols and flags have derived since then. The other, you know, moving, I think, moment in our museum is where you get to, you know, contemplate the life of Harvey Milk and really sit with his story and his voice, and particularly the suit that he was assassinated in is something that we make accessible to community. You know, I think Gerard could speak a little bit more to this, but it is a moment of reflection to understand, you know, how fragile life is.
It's hard for me to limit to two things. Certainly Roberto identified two of our most astonishing artifacts and ones that really are artifacts of international history, significance for LGBTQ history. Currently, one of the things that's very moving for me is to see one of the performance costumes of the great disco diva, San Francisco's greatest disco diva, Sylvester, we have on display this fabulous pink and ivory sequined full-length gown, a kind of modified caftan or kimono. It's really marvelous, and it reminds us of Sylvester's incredible genderqueer and gender-fluid persona at a time in the 1970s and early 1980s when that was even more nervy than it is today. And Sylvester's brilliant talent, but it's also touching to me to see it there. Sylvester lived in the neighborhood. Sylvester first started really getting noticed as a performer standing on a tabletop at the Elephant Walk Bar, which is a space that's three buildings down from our museum. Right. And Sylvester died in his apartment a block away from our museum. So to have him still there at home in our neighborhood, reminding us of his brilliant life at his tragic end from AIDS in 1988, it really is very touching for me to see that. That's on a temporary display, so I urge people to get to the museum now and see it.
Well, you know, the museum space itself is pretty small. You've talked about that. But this fall, you talked about a plan for a permanent space, a much larger space. So tell us about what the future holds.
You know, for the last 15 years, our team has done an incredible job, and our volunteers have done an amazing job in putting together groundbreaking exhibitions and public programs in this very tiny storefront in the Castro. And, you know, the reality is that there are so many stories and so many more stories that we could be telling that we just needed bigger space to do so. And, you know, Gerard and other members of our board of directors and volunteers for many, 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 many years have done so much work to advocate to have this dream become a reality. And I have to say that the city of San Francisco and the state of California have invested so deeply into making that happen. As you shared, you know, the new space will triple the size of space that we currently have, and allow us to share even more stories, allow us to really continue welcoming a global community and even more people that can come and engage with our work, allow us to have even more public programs that, you know, center community and community building and connection, something that, you know, we know people need so much of today. And we're really excited to also think about how we can leverage, you know, new technology to share our stories, how to create even more immersive type of exhibitions where we get to activate, you know, more senses, right? Than just our eyes and brains, right? In addition to that. So we're really, really excited about that. And I have to say, it has taken a community to really be able to get to this place. The city has purchased that property. We are working with the city to get to an agreement to operate the site and to then be able to design and build out that space. And is going to take the entire LGBTQ community and as many of our allies as possible to be able to bring that to fruition. We would love to meet any individual or any family or any business that wants to support our efforts. We need everyone's support right now more than ever before, as we see incredible disinvestments from the federal administration into work that we do and other and that of our sister organizations. And so, you know, I think during the last year in particular, I've been very buoyed by the fact that so many individuals and families have stepped up, knowing that so many different nonprofits right now are being challenged by federal funding cuts. We are growing the number of people that are part of these efforts, and just invite people to go to our website or to reach out to us to learn how to get involved in our efforts.
Well, the building is in a beautiful space on Market Street, just down from Castro. It is in a very primo location. There are so many ways to be involved. As a member, where should our listeners go to learn more about the different opportunities for being involved and investing financially in the future?
They can go to glbthistory.org. We can also follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook.
If you missed the website, you can go to glbthistory.org, or you can go to our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click on show notes at the top of the page, and we will have links to all that you need to know about the GLBT Historical Society. Roberto, Gerard, thank you so much for being with us tonight, but more importantly, thank you for your commitment to keeping us visible.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's such a pleasure to be with you this evening, and really appreciate being here with you tonight and with your listeners.
Yes, thank you for sharing your work, our work with your listeners, and we look forward to meeting some in the museum and seeing many paying a visit to our web resources.
And now here's Rafe DeRozzi with this month's HIV News Roundup.
Welcome to the HIV News Roundup for January 2026. This month opened with major global and clinical developments, including updated WHO HIV treatment guidance, persistent stagnation in the global epidemic, and real-world access shifts in the U.S. and abroad. Here's what matters and what will continue to shape the year ahead. This month, the World Health Organization released updated recommendations on HIV clinical management to help countries improve treatment outcomes. The new guidance confirms that integrase-based antiretroviral regimens remain the preferred starting option for most people because of their strong effectiveness and tolerability. It also expands choices for people whose treatment has stopped working, naming better second-line options. Importantly, for service delivery, WHO's updated guidance supports long-acting injectable antiretroviral therapy for people who struggle with daily pills, offering another choice for keeping people on treatment. The recommendations reflect both advances in HIV science and an emphasis on practical real-world care delivery. As 2026 begins, global surveillance paints a sobering picture. The HIV response has plateaued or regressed in key areas. WHO data show an estimated 1.3 million new HIV infections in 2024, with roughly 630,000 HIV-related deaths, trends that were already concerning before recent U.S. funding cuts and the sunsetting of key programs. With the latest disruptions, program closures, and strained health systems, the situation is likely to be even more severe in 2025, though comprehensive data have yet to be reported. On the funding front, 2025's disruptions continue to reverberate in early 2026. Reductions have severely disrupted prevention, testing, and community-led services in low- and middle-income countries, especially for vulnerable populations. In Haiti, for example, compounded funding delays and security-driven supply disruptions this year forced multiple HIV clinics in Port-au-Prince and surrounding areas to close entirely or operate intermittently, leaving patients unable to access ART, viral load testing, or prevention services. Implementing partners reported treatment interruptions lasting weeks to months for some patients. Meanwhile, in the U.S., January brought renewed attention to state-level cuts. Reports from Florida indicate that an estimated 10,000 people may lose access to affordable HIV medications due to changes in state drug coverage programs, raising immediate concerns about treatment continuity for low-income individuals. On a more hopeful note, prevention and treatment continues evolving in January through both product and policy developments. In the U.S., CVS Health added Gilead's twice-yearly HIV prevention injection, known as Yeztugo, to its commercial drug coverage lists, meaning the product is now covered by over 80% of CVS commercial plans as of January 1st. Gilead CEO Daniel O'Day made this announcement at the annual J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference. O'Day also noted they are currently seeking FDA approval for a Biclen or Bictegravir and Lenacapavir combined daily oral medication for HIV treatment. Expectations are for an FDA decision to be made in the second half of 2026. A new study linked Medicaid expansion with increased PrEP use and improved prevention outcomes, with expanded states showing greater PrEP uptake relative to new HIV diagnoses, a statistically significant structural benefit of coverage expansion. Together, these developments reflect how coverage environments materially shape prevention reach. While January's immediate headlines centered on clinical guidance and epidemiology, underlying policy dynamics threaten to shape HIV outcomes markedly in 2026. The continuing pivot in U.S. global health strategy, as observed with senior placements on major global health boards, reflects an America First orientation that has already altered partnerships and programming. As recently as January 16th, the NIH's X account, formerly known as Twitter, posted an update to NIAID's, or the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, research mission, stating that while historically it has, quote, focused on three areas, HIV research, advancing progress toward a vaccine or cure, civilian biodefense and pandemic preparedness, and all other priorities, including most infectious, allergic, immunologic, and autoimmune conditions, end quote. The reformed version for NIAID is as follows, quote, fight the diseases that impact Americans most, target the most prevalent infectious diseases using gold standard science to improve lives, advance innovation in immunology, support cutting-edge research in immunologic, allergic, and autoimmune diseases to improve patient outcomes, and strengthen safety and accountability. Strictly adhere to new federal frameworks on dangerous gain-of-function research, ensuring all NIH-funded science protects health, end quote, with no mention of HIV. At the same time, PEPFAR's long-term stability remains a live issue. Even though concrete cuts have been forestalled by bipartisan action previously, uncertainty about future U.S. foreign aid levels persists, underscoring the fragility of accounts that dozens of low- and middle-income countries rely on for prevention and treatment scale-up. Amid fiscal pressures, epidemiological stagnation, and shifting policy landscapes, January's developments underline one principle. Durable HIV outcomes depend on structural capacity, not just biomedical tools. Updated WHO guidelines offer clearer pathways to improved care. Insured coverage expansion shows that systemic policy changes can raise access. And emerging prevention and treatment strategies demonstrate that innovation must be coupled with delivery design if it is to matter. The opening of 2026 reiterates what the last year has taught. While science expands options, the shape of financing, coverage, and social support will determine whether those options translate into impact. In that space between discovery and delivery lies the decisive work for HIV programs this year. Thanks for tuning in. For continuing analysis, follow me on YouTube at Raif Darazi. For Outbeat News In Depth, I'm Raif Darazi.
In the 1980s, it was the AIDS crisis and the lack of response by the federal government that tried to erase our community and our history. But we fought back. David Robinson was a young gay man who discovered his passion for activism after joining ACT UP in 1986. Here's Finn Dearhart with more about David.
David got his start in activism with ACT UP New York, beginning with the group's first demonstration in March 1987. Over the ensuing decades, in addition to being an English and LGBT studies professor and later a high school English teacher, he's fought for a better world as both a volunteer activist and a nonprofit director, focusing especially on LGBTQ+ rights and liberation, housing and economic justice, bird and habitat conservation, climate change, and especially over the past decade, electoral politics. Welcome to the show, David Robinson.
Thank you, Finn. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to see you.
Likewise. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, and for listeners, David is a special friend of mine, and I'm just really delighted to have him here talking about activism, the roots for him personally, and also offering some practical advice for our listeners on how to get involved today in the immediacy of what's going on in our world, but has always been going on in our world. And I think a lot of people are hopefully waking up to that fact and taking responsibility in ways that may have never felt relevant to them, but now feel relevant. So if maybe you could just share a little bit about what got you into activism with ACT UP, and we will go from there.
Yeah. I had a long kind of semi-tortured coming out process with a lot of out and in high school and college. And so by the time I graduated from college in 1986, and I went to school in New Jersey, I grew up in New Jersey, close to New York City, it had been already like four solid years of seeing a psychiatrist because of being, you know, guilted by my parents and, you know, coming out as bi and dating a woman and da da da. It was a long process. And so when I graduated, I was like, I am moving to New York. I had started dancing. So I was taking dance classes, trying to be a modern dancer, and I'm going to get involved in gay liberation. And, you know, that was the summer when the Supreme Court in the Bowers versus Hardwick decision ruled that states could criminalize same-sex, you know, sex. So sodomy, quote unquote, sodomy laws, but specifically that targeted same-sex sex acts. And there had been this brief upsurge of activism in response to that, and then it just died down completely, particularly in New York. And so I spent a number of months just like going to trying to find groups in New York who were still active and going to them, and it was dead, just really moribund. A group that had been really instrumental in getting a gay civil rights ordinance passed in New York, once that was passed, there were only like three or four people in the group anymore. You know, like that kind of thing was just not happening. And I was watching, I kept myself going by watching the PBS series Eyes on the Prize about the Black Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s, and just trying to keep my eyes on the prize, that I would find, you know, people with whom I could fight for gay liberation. And one day I was in the subway and saw a flyer up announcing a massive demonstration about AIDS on Wall Street. And I love that in retrospect that it said a massive demonstration because this was going to be ACT UP's first demonstration. They had no idea who would show up. But
that.
yeah, but I went. I had never been to a demonstration before. So on that one, I stood on the sidelines. It was loud and in some way seemingly chaotic and, like very intense. And clearly it struck some chord because I went to, it happened to be, I think that was, well, the way I remember it was the next day was ACT UP's weekly meet, what would become ACT UP's weekly meeting on Monday night. But I went to whatever the next meeting was, and it certainly had a lot of energy, and there easily were, I don't know, probably by that, even the first one, probably about 100 people. It was a sizable turnout. And at first, I went to a few meetings, and like the first one or two, I was ambivalent because I wanted to fight for gay liberation. And this was like, oh, in my head, oh, well, AIDS is narrower. I want to fight. But it took only a few meetings for me to see and accept that no, the fight for gay liberation at this moment was fighting AIDS. Like, I couldn't not fight AIDS and fight for gay liberation because I had been sheltered from what was happening. This was 19 by that point, then spring of 1987, and the death toll was just mounting and mounting. So I got involved from, having attended a demo and didn't really know what my place was going to be. I joined the issues committee, which was literally folks like researching. Okay, well, Larry Kramer was yelling, drugs into bodies. Well, there were no drugs. What were these drugs going to be? So we researched the drug approval process in the US. How do drugs actually get developed and approved? And then strategized about what were the points at which we could have impact. So because I was, a nerd, I knew how to do research. So the issues committee made sense to me as a place where I could contribute. And after, I can't remember how many months, it was only a few, the man and the woman who were facilitating the meetings each week asked if there were other people who were willing to do it because these two people had day jobs and they were really, tired from it. And I knew Robert's Rules of Order from high school from doing Model Congress and Model UN. So I thought, oh, okay, whatever, I can try. And the minute you get up in front of a room, people think you know shit.
Seriously.
So.
Oh my God, yes. And maintaining the performance of that.
Right. And I had learned when I did Model Congress, and some of that was you had to speak in front of large groups of people. I had learned that you fake it, pretend to be confident, and people will think you are. And then actually, the more you practice, the more confident
Yeah.
you'll be. And I fortunately quickly found I was really good as a facilitator, and that was a great way for me to contribute. So, I was hooked.
You made a statement that I think this is really important and relevant for so many people right now about, I was wanting to fight for gay liberation. I didn't know that I was, signing up necessarily to do this in the sphere of AIDS activism, but how those are interlinked in this idea of collective liberation. It's like, a conversation on many people's table currently. But also, I think there's just something that in the current events where people are starting to see, I would say, like the limits of whiteness and in this, recent shooting in Minneapolis, where, these sorts of acts of violence from the state to subjects is nothing new. If you're a black body, brown body, trans bodies, indigenous people, it's just the story on that, the timeline goes back, to the inception of our, species in many ways. So it's like this kind of virtuosity that's performed in the left, and suddenly it's like, oh, this is actually putting us at risk too. And I've seen a ton of that online just recently. I've had my own reactions around that and the way that it feels severe and immediate, and just kind of looking at that dissociation that happens in me as it relates to other subjects that don't look as much like me. And I'm curious if you could talk to that, kind of looping this back in with this idea of liberation that we all have to be fighting for this. This isn't just like someone else's fight. And
For whatever reasons, I had already had a sense that history mattered, and so that, as I mentioned, I was watching, an ongoing show about the fight for Black civil rights and Black freedom, knowing that it was directly relevant. And I started doing then a for myself, like kind of a crash course in the history of Black activism, US, and also feminism, and even a little bit about the labor movement, and actually some of the sort of Jewish socialist and Jewish radical activism, especially in the labor movement. But so I had learned that fights, there's no one struggle that invents, the way to do things. They always build on and learn from each other. And they may introduce particular new tactics or new views or expand things, but you need to know where you've come from. And ACT UP was very receptive to that. Like a bunch of us ended up doing teach-ins. We researched, well, what was the gay liberation movement that was right before us? What did people do? And there were some members of the group who were old enough that they had taken part in that. And there were people who had been involved in the fight, against the Vietnam War and some other, like, and in 1970s feminism. And so already the people who were there understood that activism isn't to succeed has to be broader than only one narrow cause.
All right.
Also, with ACT UP, very soon, I mean, to only focus on AIDS, it turned out that was to focus on everything, almost it seemed, because it became eventually AIDS and homelessness, which eventually spun off Housing Works, the biggest, organization focused on homeless people, with AIDS. It was AIDS in education, AIDS in schools, needle exchange for IV drug use, you name it. AIDS was affecting AIDS in prisons, right? Like it. So we kept as a group expanding to meet every need we could, address every aspect of the crisis. And we saw very clearly that the media, in particular, the mainstream media, didn't, it kept, you kept getting these stories, oh, is AIDS hitting the general population yet? Like it was clear that, yeah, right, the people who were most affected were not seen as part of the general population. So that I learned really quickly that you needed to have a vision of the we that was as wide and broad and deep as possible, and still specific. We were who we were. There was diversity within ACT UP, a variety of sorts, but the majority were white gay men. And I still remember Maxine Wolf, one of my mentors from ACT UP, and also one of my dearest friends, and who had been active for many years, lesbian activism, reproductive rights, and a whole bunch of others. But I remember one day saying to the group, "Don't let anyone make you feel ashamed of being a white gay, gay white man, because there would be some other, people in the activist world who would wield that as an insult." And they're like, "Don't, you are who you are, and it's what you're doing that matters, right? Do it from a place that's authentic, and fighting for your own survival is legitimate and authentic. But learning, it shouldn't only be, you learn that you're not going to survive if it's only your
Totally.
survival is linked to other people's as well. And use your privilege. Like, don't pretend, don't be like, oh, downwardly mobile, the folks who have money pretend they don't have money. And but like one of the reasons ACT UP was able to be successful, have a lot of impact, was, and this is only one of the reasons, but people in the group who had material resources, including money, gave them, used them. I still think to this day of like Keith Haring, the artist who came to ACT UP meetings very quietly in the back. He didn't want to be seen. He didn't want to be known. But every once in a while, anonymously, he donated money that enabled us to do something that we wouldn't have been able to do. And one day, I remember we were worried that we wanted to send a bus down, a busload of bus down to DC to do something. I can't remember what the reason was, but people were like, oh, we've already spent whatever money we just raised. And I was facilitating with someone else that day, and someone came up and just handed me a note. And I read it and it was, oh, okay, you don't need to worry. Someone has donated the money for that bus. And it turned out, I found out, I didn't spread the word, but found out that, it was Keith in that case. And there were some other people, who did
So cool.
that, right? And that mattered. You didn't pretend. You didn't do this like, oh, we're going to show, I'm the most depressed, so I don't have it. Like, use the resources you've got for the collective.
Totally. I love that
And if you
music.
don't have those, there's always something you can do. There were people whose contribution to ACT UP was what we called guerrilla Xeroxing. Instead of us having to pay to have flyers for a demonstration printed, somebody worked somewhere where there was a copying machine after work, or on the sly, print off 1,000 copies. That was a huge contribution, right?
Well, what you say is so important to this conversation for the listeners too, because one of the things I really was hoping you could speak to would be exactly that, which is like, let's just say, I mean, I hear people say, I don't really know what to do. And I think some of that might be our nervous systems, reeling. Legitimately. And also everyone's nervous system is in a different place and like their ability to respond or, but wherever you are in that process, what is some practical on the ground stuff that people can do? And I think here's where creativity also, I mean, gets so, even the thing, what's going on in Minneapolis right now, the activists, there's a lot of creativity in the way that they're resisting. So I don't, for people who are listening, can you offer some just here's step one, two, three, how to get involved if you haven't already gotten involved and you'd like to, but don't know what to do to get over that hump, or if you already are involved in some, some other ways to proliferate action.
And let me preface by saying I just a few months ago moved back to the Bay Area after a number of years away, and I'm still trying to find a group that I feel like, yeah, okay, these are my peeps, these are the ones that I can be most effective with. I don't have just one to just sort of offer, but yesterday I finally attended online Indivisible's weekly Zoom. It's n noon to 1 p.m. every Thursday, and that's Pacific time. And it's always called, it's What's the Plan with Ezra and Leah. And I forgot Ezra and Leah's last name. They're two of the leaders of National Indivisible. And they were so smart and so strategic and very practical. And right now, this week and next week, and I think even a little after that, the probably the most impactful thing most of us can do if we care about the horrors that ICE is perpetrating is to be calling our US senators and US representative, and if we can, showing up at their local office and emailing them, demanding that they not and publicly commit to not voting for any appropriation bill that includes more funding for ICE, that doesn't rein ICE in, or that allows the Department of Homeland Security to move funds around so they can still fund ICE. If you go to
And
indivisible.org, it's the lead issue. you can click right through and they can help you get to your senators, your representatives through, and they explain the issues. Just under a year ago, last March, the Democratic leadership in the Senate and the House caved on, they didn't want to hold up the risk holding up the government funding. Oh, and they caved. And it was only because of mass pressure from ordinary folks like us, but strategic coordinated pressure, that they actually, we have the government shutdown that lasted because the Democrats held out. They didn't flip that time, and it was preceded by a major, the biggest demonstration probably in the history of the US, the really big No Kings one. And it doesn't sound sexy or radical to call your representatives or to show up at their office or email them, but for the when the reasons you're calling are chosen strategically, and lots of people do it, it is one of the most impactful things you can do. Because sadly, most of our elected leaders are not leaders. They're people who stand there and they lick their finger and hold it up and see which way the wind is blowing. And if there's one thing I would say about, if you want to get involved in activism, the first thing to do is try to get out of denial about how our
Thank you.
society
Yeah.
works.
Yes, thank you for that.
ICE is
Yes.
being funded by the government. They wouldn't be
Yes.
able to be hiring masses of these horribly unqualified people and sending them out with guns everywhere if there wasn't money to do it.
Right.
So, like it or not, that's one of the ways in which we have to fight back, is trying to block that funding, reduce that funding. It matters. It's not that that's the only thing to do. Here in the Bay Area, there's a group called, I think it's Bay Resistance, that I went to, one of their meetings. I was impressed. There's a lot of good stuff happening with them. Through Indivisible and through MoveOn.org, you can often find local chapters and groups in your area. And if you have the wherewithal, even if you have a few like-minded friends, forming your own little,
Totally.
chapter. And by the way, when I say Indivisible, there's a national structure and they've helped folks set up chapters around the country. And any particular chapter may not be your flavor of activism. The demographic or the way of doing things. I was at one chapter meeting, and I won't say where or when, but there was like an older white guy who was smart, but who ran the whole meeting and did almost all the talking. And I was like, okay, this is not where I'm going to be, but that's okay, fine. That one doesn't have to be mine. There's also, I recommend to people, and we can put a link in there. Oh, yeah.
Well, I was going to say we're coming up here really rapidly on time, so this is so rich and helpful. I'm wondering, like, in the next 60 seconds or so, not to pressurize you and make you speed, but is there a final offering before we go so that people can hop on?
Just go online, go on YouTube and type in Ayanna, AYANA, Elizabeth, I think it's Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, climate Venn diagram, or even just Ayanna Venn diagram. She helps you see, you find what needs to be done, what you're good at, what brings you joy. The intersection of those three is a great thing to focus on.
So, yes, that's so helpful. And thank you so much for all your passion and just being willing to share about your history and your story. And I'm excited for our listeners to be
Thank
able
you
to.
for having me on, and thank you for what you're doing to try to activate people.
And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCBFM Roanoke Park and KRCGFM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.